Hello everyone and welcome back to Darling Why, where this week I am talking to Louis about the zenith of art pop, the peak of perfection in the realm of music.
In the realm of music.
We're talking about Hounds of Love by Kate Bush this week.
I see you've coming strong.
Oh yeah. I've said it on recent podcasts when referring to Running Up That Hill. No matter how many times I listen to it, it doesn't seem to oversaturate. I never get to the point where I'm like, skip. It's a good song, but I don't want to deal with it anymore. Yeah. No. This, for some reason, transcends.
All right.
And I think, but I also think, maybe it's because of the way that like there's been a renewed popularity for Running Up That Hill in the last year or so. Let's not forget the rest of Hounds of Love. So that's why I really want to spend some time this afternoon.
I don't want to spoil too much about how I feel, but there's a song on this record which I don't understand why is not more well known.
I'm so curious as to find out what that is when we come to it, but I am going to be going through track by track, so we'll get to it.
Yeah.
Do you remember when you first became aware of Kate Bush?
Yeah, my mother used to go on about her all the time.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, hell yes.
Yeah, my mum was going on about her all the time, and then when, you know, the first time I ever heard it would have been probably an episode of Top of the Pops 2, which my mother sort of watched with the religious fervour of a regular churchgoer. But not like a regular churchgoer, someone who goes like three times, goes to like the midweek services, like runs another church. I don't know, that level of fervent.
So after the question, in my notes I've written, do you remember when you first became aware of Kate Bush? I've written, mine was probably Wuthering Heights in passing on some evening view of doing Top of the Pops 2.
Yeah.
Same origin. Yeah, no, my dad also loved having a bit of Top of the Pops 2 or Old Grey Whistle Tester. One of those oldies.
Yeah.
So I definitely saw, I think, one of those, because there's two videos for Wuthering Heights. One's inside and one's outside. But I'm fairly confident that, or a performance of her doing it, was my first kind of, somewhere in the background of my mind, I kind of knew Kate Bush existed. And then, do you remember, there used to be ads for like, you send away for like compilation CDs or like things. And they'd, in the ad themselves, they play little clips from various songs.
Like an infotainment sort of ad.
Yes. Yeah. And Babushka was one of those songs. And so for whatever reason, like that just clip of like, Babushka, Babushka. It just, I always remembered that.
Yeah.
And they were the only two songs I knew for her, by her, for like my entire childhood. I wasn't very aware of Kate Bush.
Yeah.
At some point, and I want to say my late teens, two things happened. First, I heard Placebo's cover of Running Up That Hill, which they made for their covers album. Great album. Some good covers on that. Some good ass covers on that. But that was released in 2003. Yeah. So I remember that. And then later again, I'd say when I was maybe 18 or 19, my dad recommended I learn the song The Man With The Child In His Eyes for when I used to go to his gigs and I used to do like a couple of songs.
Yeah.
And so, but I had like my own, I had like a little set, you know? Which, if you know the song The Man With The Child In His Eyes, that's the vibe.
Yeah.
That's the vibe I'm bringing to the table. But I'd never heard it before. He just was like, I really think this would suit you.
Yeah.
Go on and learn this song. So I just like really, I just obsessively listened to that song for a week to try and learn it. And I think it was after that that I was like, oh, Kate Bush is cool. Like, and I kind of dipped in and out of like random, like her singles, basically.
Yeah.
Kind of going through, you know, obviously Wuthering Heights, kind of, I really liked This Woman's Work is a really nice song as well, but just dipping in and out. And then I think it probably is at the time when like streaming music becomes a thing, because I don't own this album.
Yeah.
I don't own this album. I stream it on Spotify, but I think that's when I first started consuming like her albums as a whole.
Yeah.
As opposed to the singles.
Yeah. So
that's kind of my introduction to Kate Bush. I feel like I've grown into being a fan of hers as I've gotten older, rather than like my experience with like, say, Queen.
Yeah.
I was just a fan of Queen, I think, my entire life. I don't remember a time when I wasn't aware of Queen, but I do remember the coming into the knowledge of Kate Bush, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So to give a little bit of background on Kate Bush, if you're not aware of her, which come on, guys, get on board. but I'm working under the assumption that most people are somewhat aware of her, even if it's just through watching Stranger Things, yeah, to be honest. But she first hit the charts with Wuthering Heights when she was 19 in 1978.
Yeah.
I believe until 2022, this was her most successful single, chart-wise.
Yeah.
Because it went to number one, the first single from her debut album, The Kick Inside. She's released 10 studio albums, all of which are top 10, nine out of 10 are top 5 albums. And she's had 25 top 40 singles in, yeah, that time, one of which we've covered in a previous episode. Yes. Don't Give Up with Peter Gabriel. Yes. Check out Louis's episode on So by Peter Gabriel for more on that. And one fact, this is just a fact I enjoyed, that I found out while researching for this. Kate Bush used her first advance from EMI to take interpretive dance classes and mime training. And I love that. I think that's clear if you've watched her music videos. And it speaks to me at like a soul level, because when I used to go out dancing in college, like that just naturally, Kate Bush dancing is, yeah, what my friends described my dancing style as. So there's just something about being like 20 years old, being like, I am in the Wuthering Heights video.
Yeah.
But it's Rage Against the Machine playing, Kate. Yeah. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. So I just like that about her, that she's like, no, I'm committing to the whole art.
Yeah.
You know, the whole performance of it. So we come to Hounds of Love, which was released in 1985. It's her fifth album. So she's, you know, she's on the scene. Yeah. She knows what's what. As we come up to this fifth album, she is kind of becoming more and more in full creative control, yeah, I suppose. She's now producing things,
yeah,
as well as writing and performing, yeah, them. The previous album, her fourth album, The Dreaming, is technically her least commercially successful venture. Like I say, only top 10.
Yeah. Pathetic.
But I think it's because it was so kind of out there. There's so many, like, when you read about it, people are like, there's so many just layers of sound.
Yeah.
Like, it's a bit much.
Yeah.
For, like, commercial success. She's, yeah, like, I stand by it.
I mean, one can make the argument that if you had no idea what this album was, right, and you just played it to someone who never heard it before, yeah, and they go, well, this is a bit weird. Oh, this is, where are the songs? Oh, blah, 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 like, where are the choruses? Blah, 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 blah. And then you told them this was, like, a massive successful album by a massively successful, yeah, artist. The fucking head would explode.
But I think that this is the thing. Because this album, thing,
just as a spoiler, not even as a spoiler, but, like, this isn't, like, an album where every song follows the pop.
It's a weird album, yeah, it, yeah.
Interesting diversions.
And I think that's why I've brought up her previous album, yeah, because I think her previous album goes a lot further into the, yeah, avant-garde than this,
yeah,
and to the point where I read that, like, EMI said that her fourth album was the closest they came to, like, going back to her as an artist and being like, we need you to do it again.
Yeah.
Hounds of Love seems to be like where she finds just like this perfect balance between like artistically satisfying,
yeah,
and exploratory, but also commercially viable.
Yeah.
Like, it finds that balance. You know, you find it sometimes when any band or artist kind of goes for a new style, their first go at it mightn't hit the mark just right.
Yeah. But
you find their second go at that thing, they're like, oh, they found the, yeah, the groove now. So this album, I think she finds that groove. It's a commercial and a critical success. It's often voted one of the greatest albums of all time. So any kind of, you know, there's so many lists where this was up there. It's her best-selling studio album. And I love how commercially successful it is because, like you say, it's a strange little duck.
There are at least 3 songs on this that...
Yeah.
Like, if you were on a major and put this out now or wrote this song, they would go, no, cut those.
Cut those.
Get rid. Like, they can go on an experimental weird EP.
Yeah.
Because... no one's going to fucking give a
they
shit.
They can be the B-sides to your singles, sorry.
No, not even that. No, because it'd be like, no, it wouldn't... Like, honestly, that shit, like, Jig of Life, for,
yeah,
example.
Yeah.
Unless someone decides to use that as a TikTok sound, a record label would demand that that is removed.
Yeah.
Like,
that's where I think actually it could be successful, because I've been floating around reels lately... And there's a Celtic Woman song that is a sound on TikTok lately. And I found that so funny because in my mind, I really associate Celtic Woman with like a type of like popular Irish, yeah, trad, but like in the kind of the Mary Black sort, yeah, of world, like as opposed to like trad.
Yeah.
But I was like, why is this? It, amongst like Renfair types, yeah, I would say. And I was like, that's... But you know what I mean? Like that kind of I'm cottagecore in the woods, yeah, kind of stuff. So I think Jig of Life, certain parts of it could find a home in some sort of talk, you know? But for context, This album is essentially two suites. Yes. So if we think about the vinyl, like there's an A side and a B side, yep. and they are very, they're separate from each other and they're joined in certain ways too. But I think there is a clear distinction.
Yes.
I'll come to this later.
Oh, yeah.
Even listening on Spotify, you can hear the turn very clearly. So the first side is subtitled Hands of Love. And side two is subtitled The Ninth Wave.
Yeah.
And we'll get into both sides of this as we go. I want to talk a bit about the production, because I think that's really interesting. Firstly, don't know what genre you call Kate Bush, to be honest. Art pop, avant-garde, prog pop, post-progressive are all labels I read while reading articles for this.
I argue this is much, honestly, this album to me is as much in common with someone like 70s Genesis.
Yeah.
In many ways.
And she gets associated, I think she gets associated with like, British art pop people of the time, I would say. So like Genesis, Peter Gabriel, I think is a reasonable comparison. But yeah, I think even with all that, like the general consensus does seem to be she finds the balance between commercial and experimental on this record. And Graham Thomas, writing for Uncut, said, quote, "The Ninth Wave appeared daunting. Melody Maker's otherwise positive review shuddered in its boots at the mere idea of it. But in the And Dream of Sheep, Hello Earth and The Morning Fog, it contained some of her finest, most awesomely affecting songs. Of course, it also featured Chattering Geordies, Harsh Helicopter Blades and Violent Witch Drowning, but that's the beauty of Hounds of Love, the deeply emotional and thrillingly berserk sit side by side." And that just sums it up so well. You know, there is like really odd sounds and stuff on this record alongside just absolute like undeniable bangers, you know, real earworms of songs.
Mm.
And what's interesting, kind of, especially if you compare it to, say, like her first record, she really gets into synthesizers.
Yeah.
As she progresses through the 80s. In a way that I read that at the time, this was still like quite a new thing to be doing, to the extent that she was, the way she was using them. She loves the Fairlight CMI synth. The Fairlight is her best friend.
Yeah. I'm very, very familiar with the Fairlight CMI. It's interesting because there's an album that at some point I might talk about for a different strand of this.
I'm not going to spoil it.
Put it this way. There's an album that's on the list for Magnificite.
That loves the Fairlight?
Yes. It's okay. Like, the Fairlight CMI is, let's just say, one of the creative accesses of that particular grouping.
Yeah.
I'm not saying they blame the Fairlight CMI, but they kind of do for that album's interesting quirks.
Yeah.
And I was hearing something, literally during Around the Hell, just like, that's a Fairlight CMI. Usually I'm really crap at recognising any sort of...
Mm.
But I'm like, I literally recognise that sound, and yeah, it was a Fairlight CMI. I'm like, wow.
And it is one of really those funny things. My understanding, I've never like been in the presence of a Fairlight, like I've never touched and messed around with a Fairlight CMI. My understanding is that you can like program lots of different sounds into it. So it gives you a lot of control over, like they're very synthy sounds.
Yeah.
Like it's very clearly, if you put a synth cello in, it sounds like a synth. It doesn't sound like a cello. But it does give you a lot of control over like what different types of sounds you can get out of it. She started using it like on previous records. But it, at this point, it's a huge part of her creative process. It's not just like an instrumentation to put on top.
Yeah.
So starting with the Fairlight, a drum machine and a piano, she started creating 8-track demos in her home recording studio. And I find this interesting because when reading about like the creation of Running Up That Hill, it was the first song she wrote for this record. She wrote it in a day, right?
Yeah.
Which that's giving like the Dolly Parton wrote Jolene and I Will Always Love You on the same day energy. Like, I'm like, what? very impressive. But so after they created the demos, they didn't, when they were going to record like the real thing, they didn't just re-record it. They put the 8-track demo, put it over 24 tracks and then built around it rather than starting new. So there are like snares overdubbed on it, but the main focus of that song is on the Fairlight.
You know, And
it also feels like reading about the writing and recording of Hounds of Love, like it really feels like she finds great inspiration in the environment and place that she's in. So one of the first things her and Del Palmer did was when writing this is they moved from London.
All right.
So in 1983, they left London for Sevenoaks. And yeah, just hung out in the country. did dance lessons and that kind of peacefulness of like not having a million people around in London
Yeah.
kind of helped the creative juices flow. Some of this record's also recorded in Ireland, and you can hear that. We'll get into it, but like you hear traditional elements of Irish music included, which we'll talk about on site too.
Yeah.
But I do find that interesting to hear the kind of, I feel like nature is very present in some of these songs.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like the physical environment around you, what it's like to be out rural and in the country. And I think that does come through, which is interesting given how much synth is on this. Do you know what I mean? Like, and I'll talk, she does have thoughts about, like, which I'll get into when we talk about one of these songs, but like the different ways that, like, why choose synth here but a piano here? Like, what does that do for the song? But let's start. Let's actually talk about this record. We got to get it out of the way first. Running Up That Hill, a behemoth of a song.
Yeah.
So in a certain sense, I'm like, what is there to say? You know? This track is undeniable. And like I say, I continue to not be burnt out on it. And again, even more saturated in the last year. And it wasn't a not popular song before that.
Yeah.
This song has always just been very popular, I think. It didn't fall out of favour.
And now it's had 3 million crap pop punk / metal covers by untalented fucking losers.
Oh, you hate pop punk TikTok.
I do. I think it's awful. But like, I hate it because it requires absolutely no... Like, the hook has been written for you.
Yeah.
Like, you don't even have to write. And it, I just have a real bee in my bonnet because it's like... People like that just fucking useless. They don't celebrate art. They just fucking shit all over other people's better art.
Where's the glory of the live cover band? That's what I ask. I enjoy a live cover band. It's not the same as recording it. I think that there's a reason it persists. I think, like, from the unrelenting beat of it to the Fairlight synth riff in the intro, through to all this interesting layers and like, nuanced rhythmic shifts, right? Yeah. There's actually a lot going on.
Oh, yeah.
But she makes the songwriting seem so effortless in it. But there is a lot going on, you know? And I, thinking about it, like, she said many times, like, it's about misunderstanding in a relationship, like, particularly she has said, like, the misunderstandings that, like, men and women can have and the desire to want to, like, walk in someone else's shoes so you can better understand them.
Yeah.
But, like, lots of people also have had other interpretations along the way.
Some people think this is very literal. I've heard people interpret this incredibly literally.
Oh, okay.
As in, like, literally making an actual, like, deal with God.
Okay.
You see it in comments and stuff. You see people go like, oh man, oh, if I made a deal with God, I'd like,
But that's I think that's something about, that's art, isn't it?
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
you put it out there and now the meaning's in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah.
But I think it is like, it's still a poetic way to think about, like, we had a fight about misunderstanding and I want to be able to sort it out. I particularly enjoy the little offbeats, the syncopation, the variations of rhythm in the vocals of this song.
Yeah.
Even though the underlying drum beat, like, very consistent. Yeah. So consistent, no shifts in it. Like, the verse is starting off on the offbeat, the last choruses give this subtle but definite shift in the delivery of the lines and really just call attention to themselves because of that. And I love this is a comment for the whole record, actually maybe her whole career. Her voice is such an instrument. Which I know, look,
I agree.
I think the voice is an instrument, full stop, but she uses it with, like, a real, like, the skill of playing an instrument, I suppose. She has this capability to make these big intervals and shifts in, like, the tone and timbre of her voice throughout. And she uses it a lot, like, in the layering of vocals as backups, so, like, the oohs in the background of this. And, like, there's parts of this song, like, the bit that's come on, baby, come on, darling. There's such a desperation in that. Like, the fact that she can get that across, that earthiness of tone and that, like, pull of it. I'm like, I've heard the song 1,000 times. Yeah. And I'm still like, come on. And I like that the last chorus before the outro is, like, weird. Like, if you lock into the background voices of it, you're like, oh, that's odd. There's some strange noises. And yet, this is the big hit that it is.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's cool. Like, get that weird shit in there. And it's so undeniable that you have to be like, all right. All right. So I that's agree. So that's running great. Up that hill.
It's fantastic.
What else can you say about it, really? And I think what it is like, I don't want the excellence of that song to overshadow almost the excellence. Even this first half, which I would say is like, you know, the Hounds of Love half, which is songs about love, they're individual songs. I would say this is the banger side of the album.
Yes, it is.
Because the next song, Hounds of Love, is also a banger. I think it's an undeniable earworm. I also like this framing of love as essentially being trapped in the face of like a dog attack. Like, love is so fucking scary that it feels trapping. In an article from BBC Radio 6, she said, "When I was writing the song, I started coming across this line about hounds, and I thought, hounds of love and the whole idea of being chased by this love that's actually gonna, when it gets you, it's just gonna rip you to pieces, you know, and have your guts all over the floor. So being hunted by love, I liked that imagery. I thought it was really good." And I'm like, that's cool. Like, not just like, oh, I'm in, like the sadness or the happiness of love. It's like, no, it's hunting me down.
Yeah.
And like, even the opening kind of sample is from a horror movie. Like, it's a scary experience, which I think is an interesting take on the traditional love song, I suppose.
You're also, you're probably aware, but for a lot of folks around my age, this was a big hit for a band called The Futureheads. They did a cover of it in about 2007 or just before it.
I know The Futureheads, but I actually don't recall this cover at all.
I don't know if it was a thing in Ireland, but it was a pretty big hit here.
I should look that up later. Because it might come back to me.
Put it this way, it sounds a lot more like, I don't want to say laddish, but it's a bit more like football chanty.
Oh yeah, that's what I kind of expect,
it's not the same. The pace is upped. It's not like, you know, oh, we literally just, you know, put our vocals over the original track. It is a slightly different interpretation, but that was a big hit.
That's interesting. I'm going to look that up later.
Yeah.
I'm obsessed with, again, the layers of this song. I love the do, 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 do. I love that so much. Like, that just pops into my head sometimes. Again, the drums are great. I think they feel rounder, they feel than Running Up That Hill, but they're again very consistent, very unrelenting, heart pounding stuff, and it is still so, like, you know, there's this idea of like walking on the water, being trapped out. I in my mind it almost feels like being trapped out in the woods, you know, but it's still just sort of like, I just want to be loved, but also I cannot be known, like, I feel like that is maybe not a fully universal experience, but not an uncommon one. And there's just this, like, when she sings, "I've always been a coward," I'm like, oh, hits me right in the soul. It's so good. And I'm going to look up that Futureheads cover, because I do think, if, you know, like I say, I like the Placebo cover of Running Up That Hill because it's very different from the original.
Yeah.
So if it's quite different, it then
is,
I'm like,
it isn't.
Yeah, I mean, it's still a song.
Yeah.
It's still the same song, but like, not to just be a straight copy.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
You might like it, you might not, I don't know.
Maybe I won't, but I'm interested.
Yeah.
I'm intrigued.
Yeah.
The next song is called Big Sky.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on Big Sky?
Oh, the Big Sky is fucking incredible. Oh my God. Why is this song not more popular? This makes no sense.
This was a single as well.
That doesn't mean it was...
Like, no, it's not the peak popularity of this album.
There are loads of things that were released as singles that most of the public have no fucking... Like, there are massive artists who put out singles that basically do nothing.
Yeah.
In, like, say, the UK, but they were massive in, like, America or Germany or what have you.
Yeah.
And quite often they tend to be my favourites. This song is fucking ridiculous. This is like, I don't understand, and I know that I feel like I'm derailing things, but I don't care. Fuck you, I'm doing what I like. I do not understand how we're in a universe where people are not losing their fucking minds to this song. Like, people aren't like posting, you know, look at my cover, look at my bass cover of this, because the bass on this song is played by Youth from Killing Joke.
Hmm. There's a lot of people on this record.
Also known as Martin Glover, also known as a very, very successful producer. Like, and that cuts through.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, but it cuts through so, it's so aggressive and so forward and so driving. And this song's the most immediate song on the record. I don't understand why it's not.
That is really interesting.
Oh, by a mile!
That's interesting.
By a mile! wild.
And it's interesting that you're like locked in on the bass, because what I pulled out of the instrumentation, I think the guitar is very cool in this. I think it's I think it's very 80s art pop is how I think of it. Like very kind of Talking Heads, Peter Gabriel kind of, not jangly, but kind of in the like a cousin of jangly.
It sounds like it's a classier version of, it actually sounds to me more like a classier version of like a classic heavy metal type thing.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, I don't get Talking Heads from it at all.
Just the guitar playing style.
I don't get it from that either.
Fair enough.
No, I get
it. I defer to your judgment on this.
Yeah, like it's way too like aggressive.
Hmm. I think that the layering of the, I don't think the guitars on many of these songs are very forward. I think bass and drums are always, the rhythmic push these songs is always higher. And if there is a melodic hook, it is usually on the fairlight, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah.
So like having guitar actually in this is even in itself
at first I thought it was noticeable. Synthesized.
It could be synthesized. And I also think it's interesting, she places her voice in that kind of higher, lighter timbre in this song as well. Like not quite Wuthering Heights level, but not that kind of earthier, heavier tone she has in the first two tracks. And it does, again, you get this kind of like slightly different shift, this different feel from that. And it gives it that like real innocence to parts of this, which is not like, I was thinking about it, and like it doesn't feel like naive, but there's like a childlike sort of joy in this, because it's about looking at clouds, you know, which is very sweet. And again, she kind of like uses her voice in the backups as like a layered up instrument. I just think that's very cool. I read somewhere talking about the way she works, like she can create all these layers of sound, but in her, it almost seems like in her mind actually it's quite simple, like she can see it very simply, even though if you're the person helping to produce it, you're like, wow, there's a lot going on
here.
But she can just cut through and find the right thing that she wants, you know? Yeah. So that's really cool. But I like that. I like that Big Sky is the one that really was very immediate for you straight away.
Fucking my, I was just like, where has this song been all my life? Like, genuinely, I was just like, how are people not talking more about this? I don't understand it.
Yeah, no, I only know this by listening to this record. I haven't heard it, like, in the wild.
That song is so immediate. That song is way more immediate than Running Up That Hill. By a mile. And, like, don't even get me started on cloud busting.
Oh, we'll get to cloud busting. Like, I fucking love cloud
Big
busting.
Big Sky makes cloud busting sound like...
Careful.
I'm not going to say negative things, but I've heard cloud busting a lot of times.
Yeah.
I have to admit, I don't struggle with it, but I'm a bit like, why this, not this?
I suppose, that's interesting.
In terms of, I'm not talking about quality. I'm purely talking about in terms of success, immediacy. I don't...
Yeah,
and like,
that's fair.
I just don't quite get how this song seems to have basically in the general mind
it hasn't crashed through, like,
I'm just like, what do people just not have ears? Like, this song is also clearly ripe for shit covers as well, because it translates itself a lot better to traditional instruments of, you know, there's a recognizable bass, there's a guitar, like, I'm stunned that this hasn't been just beaten to death by shit cover artists.
No. Maybe that's my calling. Maybe I have to be the shit cover artist for the Big Sky.
Yeah.
Serenade you with. The next song, which is maybe the most uncomfortable song of the first side of this record, I think, is called Mother Stands for Comfort.
I
think this is a really interesting song. I think it's an unsettling, like sonically an unsettling start with there's the syncopated rhythm. You have these kind of like glass breaking sounds. I like that interesting contrast. You know, sonically it's very uncomfortable, but it's a song about comfort, like in the title. And Kate Bush has said that it's about a mother protecting her child who's committed a crime.
Okay.
So there is kind of like the unconditional love of a mother for their child, even in the face of like
the child being a little
something
shit
quite
bad.
Dark.
Yeah.
I think she has such great control of dynamics throughout this song and like where she chooses to project her voice, because it is kind of, you know, like I say, a bit more unsettling. I think the bass in this is excellent.
Yeah.
Really, really good. It's played quite high on the neck quite a lot. So there's these big ranges between like going all the way up the neck and then down again.
Yeah.
like creating this melody. And then this is the first track that I notice, that I think you visibly notice, you audibly notice, like the natural piano sound.
Yeah.
As opposed to like a Fairlight keyboard sound.
Yeah.
And so this is where I thought it was interesting to think about like her reflections on the differences between using synthetic and acoustic sounds. So in a 1992 interview with Richard Skinner,
yeah,
about classic albums, she said, quote, "Quite often I find synthetic sounds create a coldness, but if the track is lonely or sad or dark, sometimes you want that kind of coldness, that machine-like coldness, which is very specific.
Yeah.
And with acoustic instruments, you get a real, normally a very warm human presence. And sometimes that's intimate and really there. Something that breathes, you know, it's not this kind of dead cold machine."
Yeah.
"And I feel that both are very usable depending on what you want to say."
Yeah.
And like later in the interview, she goes on to say that like the cold synths feel appropriate for the subject matter of this song. But I do think that's interesting given how this is actually, for where we are in the record so far, I think where the like very definitely acoustic instruments.
Yeah.
Shine out, yeah, the most. But like maybe that is like sonically she's creating the scape of that contrast between like the intimate,
yeah,
unconditional warmth and love of the mother and like the coldness,
yeah,
of the act that, yeah, is happening in the song. And I think without the lyrics even, she's creating that landscape, and it makes it just a really interesting little like dark little, like for this first side anyway, yeah, this dark little weird pocket, yeah. But it's, again, so, like, it's really intentional in how it uses different sounds and different, like, timbres and instrumentation and all those things.
Yeah.
And so we get to the final song of side one, Cloud Busting. This is the song that tends to pop into my head out of the blue the most. Not Running Up That Hill, Not Hands of Blood. This is the one that will just earworm its way out of the fucking ether.
Really?
Yes. Especially the strings.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I have to admit, there have been times where, like, people talk about this song, and I genuinely do forget
which one it is.
Yeah. And then someone says the strings. I'm like, oh, yeah. Yeah, there it is. There it is.
The strings underlying throughout, and then there's, like, a real rolling drum beat. Like, you get a real, like, rolling, yeah, long drum beat, and it comes with the every time it rains.
Yeah.
Like, I'm like, oh, yes, yes. Yeah. Like when a beat drops, but that's not what it is. Yeah. But it's that feeling. And even though this is like a song about a very specific story, which I'll get into in a second,
yeah,
I still think it feels like she's tapping into something universal there. Uh-huh. Because like, I both like don't like when things get lifted out of the context of a song, because I'm like, the song is the song as a whole. But I'm, yeah, going to do exactly that for one moment.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to back it up.
Yeah.
When it comes to like feelings of love, which is what this side of the record is, yeah, about, like, I don't usually advocate detaching a chorus from the rest of this song, but just like that moment where she goes, I just know that something good is going to happen.
Yeah.
I think that like can, that just, you know, permeates all types of feelings, love and relationships, yeah. Yeah. Not just the type of relationship that this song is talking about.
Yeah.
But so that I do not fall into that trap, I am going to back it up and give some context to what the song is actually about.
Right.
Because this song is based on Peter Reich's 1973 memoir, A Book of Dreams,
okay,
which explores his life with his father, Wilhelm Reich. Wilhelm Reich was an early psychoanalyst. He was like second generation after Freud.
Okay.
So like quite early in psychoanalysis. He wrote several influential books. The Impulsive Character, The Function, mm-hmm, of the Orgasm, Character Analysis, oh, and The Mass Psychology of Fascism,
oh,
in the 20s and 30s. And then he went on to explore esoteric theories of life energy, which he called organ energy.
Oh, right.
And Reich also invented a machine called the Cloud Buster, which you point at the sky to make rain and then harvest that energy.
Yeah.
So the big problem comes when, mm-hmm, he starts building and selling things he calls organ accumulators,
yeah,
which are modified Faraday cages,
yeah,
which he said was beneficial to the treatment of cancer.
Oh.
So as you can see, things are about to,
right,
go off the rails. And the FDA was like, absolutely not.
Yeah.
Injunction on you. You're not selling those. And or the literature associated with it.
Yeah.
He did in fact violate this. He violated this injunction, and so he was given 2 years imprisonment.
Yeah.
So this song comes from, oof, the perspective of his son Peter.
Yeah.
The kind of the memories he has with his father, and then those feelings of his father getting taken away.
Yeah.
And he's a child, he can't do anything about it. And in that Graham Thomas article for Uncut, says, quote, "But rather than grappling with Reich's bizarre practices, Bush wrote a song about the touching relationship between a child and his mysterious magical father, a man who made it rain. She sent an early treatment of the song to Peter Reich."
Wow.
"And when we were doing the vocals, she got a letter back from him saying he loved the idea of what she was doing," recalled Spendl. Spendl was one of the people working on the album that I was talking to in the article. But like, I think to hear kind of, and you can read a lot more detail about Wilhelm Reich and his story. But like to focus in more on like what it's like to be a child growing up in that. There's a sweetness to that.
Yeah.
There's a, I don't think that is like, that's not the angle I think that is there in like Neon Lights being look at me. It's such a subtle sideway into that story. And such comes the end of the Hounds of Love half of this record.
Mm.
And now we approach side two. The Ninth Wave. And essentially this is a mini concept record.
Yeah.
Kate Bush described it as being, quote, "about a person who's alone in the water for the night. It's about their past, present and future coming to keep them awake, to stop them drowning, to stop them going to sleep until the morning comes."
Yeah.
And it starts with maybe the most literal setup of this, which is "And Dream of Sheep." But like I say, this really resets the tone. So even though I'm not listening to this on vinyl, for example, and need to flip it.
Yeah.
You still, I think there's such a feeling of separation once this song starts. Like coming off Cloud Busting into And Dream of Sheep just feels like a very definite reset.
Mm.
And coming back to what she said about the different qualities between synthetic and acoustic instrumentation, I think this song is very heavy on like piano and guitar with some whistle at the end.
Yeah.
And it gives it that much more natural feeling, like with the real focus on the water the narrator is caught in. Mm-hmm. And it kind of just like sets up what the story of this, you know, seven song arc is going to be.
Yeah.
And again, Graham Thomas writing for Uncut. Donal Lunny later recalled how Bush asked him to play the single whistle note at the end of And Dream of Sheep for 3 straight hours until she heard the desired bend in the note. I thought that was just a fun fact.
Yeah.
Imagine playing one note on the tin whistle for 3 hours.
Yeah.
You ever played a tin whistle, Louis? You know how the pitch that can hit?
Yeah.
I have one in the house somewhere. I don't play it because we have neighbours, you know. Yeah. I feel like it's... But I like the idea of like, I'm just waiting for that bend.
Yeah.
Keep going, Donald. And then that leads into the song Under Ice. So in this dream song where you follow yourself drowning under the ice, there's a quickening pace from the go. There's a real sense of urgency and uncertainty with this. And there's a very dark tone when she's layering the voices in this.
Yeah.
In contrast to her delivery of other lines in the song. Like there's such, it's such, again, so interesting sonically to listen to this.
Yeah.
And it like mirrors the string lines underneath. So there's all this like I say, kind of duplication sequencing, but contrast. And it's I like it. Like sometimes it's different voices, it's samples. But sometimes it is just her own voice used in very different ways to contrast against each other. We go into what I think is maybe the most interesting song of certainly the second side, which is Waking the Witch. Waking the Witch, according to Genius.com, is the first in a series of 3 songs about the hallucinations experienced by the woman as she slowly freezes and runs out of oxygen. The 3 songs appear to follow like a past, present, future pattern. So Waking the Witch is the past.
Uh-huh.
And it's basically the story of someone who's on trial for witchcraft.
Right.
And it is odd.
Yeah.
It's a weird little song. It's such an interesting choice to have like all this found audio sprinkled in as like a "you must wake up."
Yeah.
There's all these different voices in different ways basically being like "you must wake up." And even the music with it has this discordance to it. There's references to later songs with like "a little light." So you're starting now to string the different threads of this concept mini album together.
Yeah.
So they're not just songs one after another, but they're now locking in.
Yeah.
It does kind of sound with that found audio like you're sort of passed out and vaguely aware. Have you ever fainted? And you kind of, you're not quite out of the faint yet, but you're kind of vaguely aware of what's going on around you. You're like, you can hear some voice and like, oh no, I got, I passed out because I got this like injection or whatever. I've fainted quite a bit in my life.
Yeah.
So I am very aware of like, you know, people being like, you can hear them going like, oh no.
Yeah.
But it is that kind of slightly distant, I don't quite know where I am kind of feeling.
Yeah.
And then at a certain point in the song, it all just kicks off.
Yeah.
And gets fucking weird. And you have some like Latin choral stuff with church bells. You've got this bit of a demon voice going on with Kate Bush and a bass pushing through with other lyrics. And I feel like because of all, it's very cinematic. It's like this horror movie scene. And even though it's like one of the stranger songs on the record, I still think it kind of creates like this soundscape, this picture.
Yeah.
That is more akin to me to being like, say, watching a movie, being in the cinema, than necessarily like listening to a pop song.
Yeah.
And I really like the end where it's like, get out of the waves, get out of the water. Yeah. It's lower down in the mix, so it feels more distant.
Yeah.
And you get this connection, I think, with like back to the concept of like witch trials with like the water drowning test.
Yeah.
Damned if you do, damned if I don't. If I get out of the water, am I a witch?
Yeah.
Or am I just going to drown? You know, I think that's an interesting question to pop in there as well.
Mm-hmm.
The next song then is Watching You Without Me. It's kind of like the present of those three songs.
Okay.
This is basically told through the eyes of a spirit or a ghost.
Yeah.
I think it has the most 80s Tears for Fears drum sound. It could be Mad World, like that drum sound. But again, there's just something slightly discordant about it. It's like, to put you on a little bit on edge.
Yeah.
Just a little bit. Not full like clash, but just I think the second half does have like a slight tinge of that kind of Twin Peaks backwards voice.
Yeah.
Even if I don't know if that's what they did or not, but that it gave me a similar feeling. And I think it's cool because it's like, we see you here like a ghost would.
Yeah.
Ghost songs.
Yeah.
And then that goes into Jig of Life, which I do want to really kind of get into. So Jig of Life is the third in that series of three songs, and it's thinking about the future. So
right.
This is the future. The drowning woman is confronted by her future self, who tries to convince her to fight for their life. And the first thing I wrote when kind of listening through and kind of writing my thoughts down as I listen to the record is, give me that Irish trad fusion. Love a bit of art. This is my Leaving Cert education.
Yeah.
Being like, you have to do a whole section on like Irish music, and you have to be able to write essays and stuff on it. And I do like when you bring in that good trad shit into like modern music. I like that it's like the Irish musicians on this record are like significant Irish musicians.
Yes.
So you have John Sheehan playing fiddles and whistles. He played with the Dubliners for a very, very long time.
Yeah.
Liam O'Flynn on the Illan Pipes of Planxty. Donal Lunny on the Bazooki and Baron of Planxty, Bothy Band, and a bunch of other, like a ton of bands and duos and all sorts of stuff. And like all three of them have contributed a lot to other records by both like Irish trad artists or trad adjacent artists, and also just more mainstream pop artists. Like this isn't...
Uh-huh.
Their first time working with the likes of Kate Bush necessarily, you know. So they have like some top tier, like I learned who all these people were in like a textbook.
Yeah.
Like they're that level, you know, we got to teach about these guys in schools.
I see.
They're still around, you know. I thought what was interesting, the first half of this song is not a jig.
No. I agree.
It's in 4/4, so it's not a jig.
Yeah.
I was like, is it a reel or is it just a song in 4/4? I don't know enough about Irish trad to say, but it does break into a pure jig at that instrumental.
Yeah.
So it does work. And then it goes back to 4/4 for the return of the original song.
Mm-hmm.
And so obviously this is one of the songs that was recorded in Ireland. But I really love it. I like that there's essentially a poem at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Like that a lot. You know, not to be too, oh, did you know I'm from Ireland? But like, it's like, you know, this is why it's nice to go to like a Cayley or one of the, you know, trad night or something, to hear that level of like skill and stuff in the music.
Yeah.
And to hear how it's fused with the rest of the song. Like this isn't, the song around that kind of jig instrumental section isn't written like a trad song.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like similar to the way our song tradition works or anything.
Yeah.
So it's that fusion element that interests me about it. And also, like I say, I think it's just cool to have some like, you know, legends of Irish trad in on this as well. What are your thoughts on...
Oh my word, it's hot, right.
Is there anything thus far? So I've been pounding through the ninth wave.
Deliberately didn't look up any sort of deep meanings for the ninth wave.
Oh, okay, interesting.
Because I wanted to see if I could, quote, not guess it. Because
mm-hmm.
that would imply that there's something to get, you know, that might not be how it was written.
Do you get the theme on your own kind of thing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did not get the theme on my own. At all.
Fair enough.
Honest to God, I thought maybe this is about the earth maybe this is about, like, I don't know, a person's rebirth from some sort of, not abuse, but...
But something.
Something.
A lot of people do take that interpretation that it's a rebirth story.
And
it's not necessarily what Kate Bush says, but it is a popular interpretation of this.
I mean, the first time I heard it, when it went full jig...
Oh, yeah.
When it went full jig on jig, my brain was just like, I appear to have walked into a Renaissance fair. I'm or, LARP.
Or he's gone to the Willie Clancy Festival. One summer in Clare. Maybe I could bring you to that one year. That's a lot of fun.
Maybe I've gone to the pub with you and your dad.
Yeah, literally. Yeah. I was just like, I can bring you to... If you want to hear a jig, mate, I'll bring you to hear a jig any night of the week. Yeah. I'll find you somewhere they're playing a jig.
Yeah.
It's not that hard to find back home. But yeah, like that's, like I say, there's two more songs to go, but just to reflect again, this is... a huge commercial hit.
Yeah.
This is Kate Bush's most successful record.
This is what I mean. This is what I said earlier. This is why I brought it up, because by all logic, people should have heard this and gone, this is absurd. Like, no, where are the songs?
Yeah.
Like, throw it away. Like, honestly, you just would not be able to pull this now.
Hmm.
You just would not be able to, because what would happen is...
Not in a major.
No, because if you did that, all your fucking social media stands would absolutely... bury you.
I suppose that's why you got the first half of this record, don't you?
Yeah.
That
like, I because, you know, people say, oh, you know, oh, Beyonce's made it so that she's progressive. Like, yes, but also
at
no point straight does up Beyonce up. Start writing stuff like this.
Yeah, yeah. This like, is,
you know, Taylor Swift with, you know, she wrote 10 minutes, oh, it's a 10 minute version of a song. Like, well done, welcome to progressive music.
Yeah.
But also, that song is not going in weird structures. It's not one repeating
note. It's not one repeating note for 10 minutes. In any way, particularly. You know,
it's not challenging in that sense. It's just a long story. It's like there's no...
Sure.
You know,
Amanda Palmer writes really, really long songs. Yeah. Like a lot of her songs are 8 to 10 minutes long, but I wouldn't say that they're like this necessarily. They are just longer songs that have a longer story to them.
Yeah.
But the structures of them are still largely...
Yeah.
A pop rock structure.
Yeah, yeah.
So just the length of something.
Yeah.
I know if you're not used to songs that are kind of past the 5 minute mark, essentially.
Yeah.
It can seem quite like, oh, that's unusual. But sometimes songs are just long.
Yeah.
Whereas like, just because we were talking about them yesterday, but like, you know, we're not going like full Devin Townsend exploring, you know?
It's not fucking Dream Theater. It's not,
that's what I mean.
It's not King Crimson. It's not Yes. It's not ELO. Not ELO. Emerson, Lake and Palmer, you know, it's not Genesis. When I say Genesis, I mean like...
70s Genesis.
In particular, yeah.
Yeah.
It's not The Lamb Lies Down on fucking Broadway.
But this is odd. This is exploratory.
You know,
this is trying things.
Like, where are the choruses? Like, that's what I'm saying. It's it's not because...
This second side is devoid of chorus.
Yeah, there's no like... Yeah. Bit you or everyone's going to sing along to.
No.
There's no like, now on top of the bubbles, you know, I'm not sure who would been presented on 95 because whatever. I don't think it was The Bad Man, but, you know, it might have been, I don't know, fucking Mike Freeman or someone. I don't know.
I know she debuted running up that hill on Wogan. Another Irish connection.
Yeah.
Limerick man, Terry
Wogan. I cannot do a Terry Wogan anymore. I used to do a
did
one.
Oh, did you? Okay-ish one,
but I haven't heard the man's voice in years.
If the quality of the impression is similar to the quality of the statue of him, then it's fine.
I mean, I'd like to think it's slightly better than the statue. That statue is...
We need to pilgrimage to the statue.
That statue makes me smile. Every time I've seen it, makes me smile.
We'll go check it out again next time I'm home. But the last two songs then are... So the first one is Hello Earth. And this song in the story is like as the drowning woman's like last bit of strength leaves her. So you hear a lot from like the rescue team, like the get out of the waves, get out of the water. So people are still trying to reach her, but there's kind of far offness to them, and she's kind of withdrawing back into the earth almost.
Yeah.
And like it's interesting because I think the motif of this opening, like the melodic idea.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that's just like a common idea that Kate Bush likes, because I think you see that with artists a lot. Like you can see images or phrases or certain like structures, like harmonic structures that they just kind of go back to.
Yeah.
Or if it's like specifically threaded throughout the records, that, that shape of a melody. This song particularly, as someone who, especially in my youth, was very artistically obsessed with like the moon and the ocean.
Yeah.
Like I must include the moon and or the ocean in whatever creative thing I'm doing. This record, this really scratches that itch, this song. And I like, there's like a kind of a choral or Gregorian chant thing going, but like with a ton of effects on it.
Yeah.
Like it's really put through that synthesizer heavily. And it's creepy as it's creepy.
Yeah.
It's very unsettling. And we kind of go back to the get out of the water. We're bringing back the fiddle. We reference Cloudburst.
Yeah.
And like as a musical's head, I do love when we have this sort of reprise of previously set out ideas to make this new whole. It's very satisfying.
Yeah.
And I think that's what makes this kind of work as like a concept mini album on the second side, rather than again, just like a string of songs on a theme.
Yeah.
You are connecting, you are locking in those threads together.
Yeah.
And then the last song is The Morning Fog.
Yeah.
And it's nice.
Mm.
It's nice to end this on like a brighter little lift. Like, hooray, I didn't drown. And now I have a new perspective on life. And I really like the line in it. Do you know what? I love you better now.
Mm.
I love that line so much. I wonder, I don't know if this was the intention or not. I wonder, is like this, is that the resolution to the fear of love that we see in Hounds of Love?
Mm.
Do you know what? I love you better now.
Yeah, I can see that. And now you say that, yeah.
Yeah. And Kate Bush has said like, People, I suppose, will have discussed, does the character in The Ninth Wave, like, die at the end?
Yeah.
And then is reborn. And Kate Bush is like, no, the person lives. They live. And they have this new perspective on life. But, like, many fans still do kind of take more of a rebirth sort of slant on it.
Yeah.
But I do, again, I just really love that line, do you know what, I love you better now.
Yeah.
And having a new lease on life because of what you've gone through.
Yeah.
And I just think it works. Like, it's a different experience than listening to the first half of the record, of course. Like, again, I don't think you're whipping these out on an 80s night.
Yeah. Nope.
At my 80s night. At my oddball 80s night.
I'll at the peak, everyone's going crazy. You're going to put on Hollow Earth.
No, I'm going to put on Jiggle Life. I often, when I do these album episodes, I don't necessarily talk about every single song.
Yeah.
But I just think, like, the way that all of these work together, and the fact that like this is considered such a classic album, like this is undeniably objectively agreed upon as a classic album, that, you know, I'm going to take that extra bit of time to really get into the weeds of it with you.
And so that's
all I got.
Yeah.
Any further thoughts on Hounds of Love?
It's a fascinating record, even if you're someone who would like, as is everything in the world, there's obviously people who don't like Kate Bush. They find this sort of thing a bit too, I don't want to say pretentious, but like a bit too weird.
Yeah.
Like that it doesn't speak to, and but even if this doesn't speak to you, it's still one of the most interesting records you'll hear, because purely from the perspective of this is an album by a quote massive artist.
Yeah. Certainly on the side of the Atlantic.
And it's fucking bananas. Like, it's both not challenging in terms of, you know, it's not 30 minutes long.
No.
Every song's 30 minutes long, and half the songs are just her, like, punching meat, like Scott Walker on The Drift. Or it's not fucking Swans, where it's just like, you know, or somewhere it's just like,
just
or
noise. The song
where it's just, it just drones, or it's drone, where it's just the same note for like 30 minutes.
Yeah.
It's not that, but there's enough, you know, it lures you in, and then it's just like, and now we're going to have a whole song of just a woman going, oh, waiting, oh, water, you know, and like oh, I'm in the ice, oh, you know, all that fun stuff. It's one of those fascinating records. Like,
And like I say, the fascinating bit is that it was so successful.
Yeah.
It was so successful. And like, even like the side A, which is like the, you know, arguably like the pop side, is still odd in its own way. Like, it's still, there's a reason why she is like essentially like the queen of art pop, because I do think she can find, she finds that balance, she finds the way, I think, to put these very unusual, like interesting ideas, or kind of angles people haven't explored before, be able to put them out there in a way that is actually, for what it is, quite accessible.
Yeah.
You know, for what it is, quite accessible. Like, I think that from again, this is from reading articles and stuff, I think, like, she does have more success in the UK.
Yeah.
It kind of fits the and I think, like, the scene kind of that she was in, the sensibility of the UK kind of makes more sense. She didn't have as much success in America.
Yeah.
Certainly around this time. Yeah. I can't speak to now, but still, you know, it's the fact that it is so continually rated.
Yeah.
Even they're almost 30 years.
Yeah.
Almost 40 years later.
Mm.
Mm. I forgot time, but yeah, it's like 38 years old. It doesn't sound jaded,
yeah,
or boring, because this has not been done to death.
No,
this still stands as like a unique property, I suppose.
Yeah,
a unique little exploration.
Yeah,
but yeah, let's go listen to Kate Bush. Listen to this record. Listen to The Kick Inside. Listen to any Kate, but honestly. Listen to some Kate Bush.
Yeah.
Have a nice little 80s night for yourself in your own home.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's it for me.
Mm.
What are you going to talk about next time?
I'm going to take us in a very different direction. I'm going to go back to when I was...
But a young boy.
Not so young that I don't remember any of this, but young enough that, you know... I couldn't just reach the top shelf in the kitchen, you know.
Oh.
That sort of level. I couldn't just, like, get a pan and start scrambling some eggs, you know. Not yet. I'm not there yet. But I'm going to go and talk about a video game called Wipeout 2097. A game that had a very, very deep impact on how I see, like, basically what I think is fucking cool.
Fair enough. I've never heard of this before.
It's a racing game.
Cool. I'm excited to find out more.
Yeah.
And I will do next time.
Oh, you will. All right then, everybody. Thank you so much for your time. Really hope you enjoyed this episode. We will see you next time.
Bye.
Goodbye. You were listening to the Darling Why podcast presented by Louis Tangarides and Kate Stewart. If you liked what you heard, please feel free to give us a follow at Darling Why Podcast on Instagram. Feel free to rate and subscribe on whatever podcast feed you're listening to. This podcast is produced, edited, and put together entirely by Louis Tangarides and Kate Stewart. Thanks for listening. See you next time.